Hi, y'all. We are back today, and I have two special guests here. And listen, this has been a conversation I've been having over and over. I did an intro episode on what is PDA. That was episode 110. You're going to want to go listen to that if you're new to this PDA world, get an understanding of what it is. But something that I keep hearing over and over again, even in feedback for that episode, is like, great, we're doing all these things at home. What do we do about school? That is where the struggle is.
Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed, and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. Two decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast, and I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support.
And so I'm so excited today. I have Jessica Hanzo. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She is an early childhood therapist and consultant here on the podcast with us today, as well as Lisa Baskin-Wright. She is a former high school teacher, an IEP coach, and both of them have lived experience in this realm too, not only in terms of their professional side, but in terms of navigating all of this personally. And I'm excited to be able to have both of them on. They put their brains together to put this course together. It's called Supporting PDA Learners, and it's all about the IEP process. Y'all, I went and got this course. That's how excited I was for this. We're going to give you some highlights today so that really the goal of this episode is, how do you start having this conversation with your child's school team? What are some key accommodations and support strategies? And then just understanding the IEP process a little bit more broadly, although there are previous episodes as well diving into IEPs more. So we're going to get to the conversation. Jess, Lisa, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you both here today.
Thank you for having us. It's so exciting to be back with Jessica. And it's so nice to finally officially meet you and be here having this conversation.
Yes, absolutely. So I think let's start out by this idea of like, where do parents even start in bringing this up? Although I'm sure there's also some professionals listening to this who might be part of a team, and they might also be going, how do we start bringing this up if they're identifying PDA learners? So what would you say is the start of this conversation when schools often have not even heard of this theorized profile of autism and what it is?
Typically, and I think this transcends, but very specific to PDA as well, is I think this conversation actually starts with parent input. And in the IEP process, and you probably discussed this in a previous episode, and if there's anybody out there that follows me, I've talked about this quite a bit, that as part of the IEP process, you are an equal member of that team. And so you're often asked for your input about your child's strengths and the concerns that you have for them in the educational setting. And there are ways to front load a team with some information. And so there's something called a parent input statement where you can share some of that information about your learner. And so the way I like to write them is, in essence, a capture of who the child is. That's how I always start. But if I am trying to introduce this idea of PDA or sensitive neuroception or a threat response to perceived loss of autonomy, I'm going to start to name it in this letter and start to describe for them what that experience may be like, what it may look like in the context of a classroom. One of the things that is so important for any learner, but in particular here, is engagement, dysregulation, anxiety, overwhelm. All of those things look very different from learner to learner. And so if we haven't given the team this accurate capture of how those things present for this child, then they are very likely working with the wrong measuring stick. And so they're going to miss some of those early tells for nervous system activation, for anxiety, for upset, and then things will escalate before they want them to, right? Not that anybody wants anything to go south in a classroom, but it's like it gets bigger before you know it. And all of a sudden the team's, oh my goodness, we have this really unsafe situation. Now what do we do? Yeah. And then the adult is activated, the child's activated, all the things. So for me, I think it starts with that early communication prior to even gathering at the table, so that when you come to the table, you can then take a deeper dive into exploring who is this young person and how do they operate in the world.
Do you recommend when a parent is initiating, hey, I want my child to be considered for an IEP, that they're including this parent input right from the get-go?
Elements of it. Okay. So when a parent wants to initiate the IEP process, I always recommend they do so in writing.
Yeah.
You do not need to have a diagnosis of anything in order to begin an IEP process. But I always recommend listing out what some of those concerns may be in an educational setting. So your child may or may not have an autism diagnosis. They may or may not have a generalized anxiety disorder diagnosis, ADHD, whatever. But there are things that you're noticing in the home environment or what you're noticing from your student when they come home from school that has you concerned about how they're accessing their educational environment. So listing some of those things out, and I don't think you need to be coy in that letter, but I also don't think you need to like dive all the way in. I would say you would dive more deeply in a parent input statement, but I would list some of the reasons why you're making this request in the first place and why you think these differences in your child are going to impact their access to education.
And Jessica, you had something to add, and I'd also love for you to comment a little bit just briefly on this difference of a clinical diagnosis versus the educational diagnosis, because I hear this as a whole, we hear it in the autism field, but I feel like a lot of times with these kids that have the PDA profile.
Yeah, a lot of kids will qualify for a medical diagnosis, but not a diagnosis when they're going through the IEP process. So it can be different. But one thing I was going to add to what Lisa said, which I think connects to this, is that we in our course included two sample parent input statements for this reason. One where we explicitly talk about PDA and name it and explain it, and one where we don't, but we're still talking about what you might see, right? That sensitive neuroception, that high need for autonomy. And that's because, right, it's not necessarily going to be recognized by the school. Not providers are going to be necessarily open to it or familiar with it, or maybe they're eligible for an IEP under an anxiety disorder, right? So we want to give language that can still help guide them towards best practices, even if we don't have a team that's going to recognize this profile of autism.
Yeah. And I think that spelling it out for them too, sometimes can get us around like this argument, at least initially, of we don't see the autism or we don't see the anxiety in the school setting, but saying, here's what I'm observing, describing that, I think makes sense of one of the ways that you can continue to go down this route. Because I think a lot of parents, I don't know if either one of you find this, but they almost get stuck when they request, you know, an IEP evaluation, and then school's like, oh, we don't see a need for it. And then they're quickly dismissed. And that parents don't sometimes realize that they have the right to say, I want to keep moving forward, even though you're not seeing this. And I think a lot of parents, yeah, get stuck there. I hear this quite a lot of, yeah, we tried and they just gave us a 504 plan. They said, oh, they won't qualify for an IEP. Here's a 504. So any like key pieces that you'd recommend in really emphasizing as you're going on this journey, especially with the PDA framework in mind?
Yeah, I don't know that anybody can see my face, but my whole face just cringed when you said that. Mm-hmm. And to me, I do think that families hear this quite a bit of, they seem fine and everything's great and I don't know what you're talking about, but we are acknowledging that there is some disability because we're going to do this by before they're doing somebody a favor. And to me, predetermination is a big no. You cannot predetermine the outcome. That's why we go through the evaluation process with fidelity. And there's ways to nicely name it, but you know, a team can't just tell and just move on. So if they're going to deny your request for an evaluation, they need to do so in writing in what's called a prior written notice. Mm-hmm. And there has to be data and rationale. And they seem fine. It is not data or rationale. And yes, sometimes we do land at a 504. And for some learners, a 504, a really thoughtful accommodation plan, can provide meaningful access to education. And sometimes the direct services of an IEP actually is problematic for a PDA learner because there's too much demand that comes from those direct supports. So we have to be thinking about the individual learner, but if you're getting stopped at the start, it's really not okay. And so naming that you're concerned that there's predetermination, naming that you are putting this request in writing and that you need to hear back within 15 days with data and rationale if you're going to deny it is really important. But I also think that, and this speaks to naming some of this in a request letter, but also in the parent input statement, which you can submit a parent input statement with a 504 as well. It's not limited to an IEP, of what those tells are for your individual child for those early signs of nervous system activation. Because we all know in this virtual room that the likelihood that the child is quote unquote fine at school and that this is a home problem is not true. It's just a different presentation that's happening within the school environment. So how can we help attune the lens of the school team towards what those tells are?
Yeah. So actually, that reminds me of a question I've been wondering of going through the course. And I loved this recommendation. And then I talked with a few parents about it. And then I saw both sides. So one of the things you guys recommended was asking if you can do like an observation in the classroom. Loved that. This was a family that I presented it to actually didn't have a therapeutic support team. So there were no therapists that could go out and do this. So our only option was the parent themselves. And then the mom was basically like, he's going to be totally different with me. And school had been building up this narrative. And literally I've heard this in so many of the families I'm working with, where it's a mom problem because mom is their primary co-regulator. And it's, oh, but they're fine when you're not around. Any tricks or suggestions there of or creative ways? Or have you guys hit that where it's like the only person that can do it is mom, and mom is going to shift the dynamic? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I think a parent observation can be really challenging for a lot of those reasons. And I think we do talk a little bit in the course as well about other ways to identify kids who tend to have a more internalized stress response at school. And is the kid coming home without having touched their lunch? Are they not going to the bathroom when they're at school? Are there these other things going on that we can outline and make more concrete that teachers aren't going to notice because they tend to notice the big behaviors, right? The things that they're struggling with, not so much noticing the things that a child might be quietly struggling with. So when that's the case, I tend to try and get more creative and lift up those pieces.
That's great. I love that. Yeah. No, but when you guys said that, I was like, that is genius. And I will say, as a provider, I didn't even know that was possible, that parents could advocate for that. I've been in schools before when able to collect some of these data.
And when it does work, parents really recognize and are attuned to their kid. So they're going to see a whole different child than the teacher. And that's so helpful because they're going to see when the kid starts looking down and shut down or things that a teacher might miss, right? So if it is possible, it can be really helpful.
Yeah. And one thing I had recommended with this family, like one, was there an observation window, especially for this was a preschooler, or some schools, I know many schools, but some schools do have like ongoing recordings, right? Can you review the recordings sitting with the principal or a teacher, that type of thing as well? Obviously public schools, that's not the situation, which I know we're largely talking about IEPs, but I also think helping any teachers, educators understand about PDA can be really helpful. Yeah. So let's talk about this idea of what you guys call mutual endeavor, or like this shared understanding, and how you even start that process of helping them to understand that if it is more externalized, that it's not just a child that's trying to push back and has to fall under like that, like emotional behavioral disturbance category. I have some families like that now, or also even some of the more subtleties of this stress response. How do you get on the same page as a school, particularly when I find schools have a very behavioral lens that they come at things from?
Yes, this concept of mutual endeavor comes out of the early childhood mental health consultation model. I think it's Khadija Johnston who wrote about it. And this is where we really want to help a team, right, to make a lens shift so that they understand the role of the nervous system in the child's behavior, and that the behavior they're seeing is brain state dependent. And that shift is what sort of guides us towards all of the brain state aligned interventions and strategies that we really go into depth in the course.
Define brain state real quick in case a parent isn't familiar with it.
Right. So this is where we're talking about sensitive neuroception. So a child that has sensitive neuroception is really easily activated or might perceive threat when someone else doesn't, or when someone else can't see it. It's a subjective experience. So for kids with sensitive neuroception, we can't always tell when they're going into their fight or flight response. And that's what we're really trying to help a team understand by making some of the behaviors more concrete that are tied to these higher states of activation, so that a team recognizes the level of dysregulation that a child is experiencing, because a child that's has their nervous system really activated isn't in their thinking brain. And when we assume that a child is in their thinking brain, we're often going to intervene in ways that aren't helpful. And we're going to assume maybe negative intent, that a child is willfully trying to manipulate us, or just assign negative intent to the behavior.
Yeah. And then I also think a lot of times it comes with strategies as well as explaining why it's not right. And,
they,
at that point, like the processing isn't happening in the same way. And so we need less of that versus more. And I see sometimes I'll get reports of kids continuing to activate as a result of this, because the strategy isn't matching what the kid actually needs in order to regulate and feel safe in their body in that moment.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think going back to what we were talking about before, just starting to name this through either the request for the evaluation and then that deeper dive with the parent input. But one of the things that Jess and I do in the course as well is use the team's own findings, their own data. And going into writing this course with Jessica, I was really not a huge fan of FBAs, of functional behavioral analysis. I'm still not, in the sense of I feel like they don't take a deep enough dive. I think that they presume to understand the internal experience of a learner, where nobody can know truly the lived experience and the internal experience of another human being. If the child is experiencing episodic memory and there's something in the environment that's triggering essentially a trauma response or a panic attack or whatever, you can't really know that. So I think they're very limited in scope. Having said that, when you read an FBA or a behavior intervention plan, a BIP, you can actually see all the triggers, right? It's when a demand is placed, they're given direction, transitions, right? There's all these things where it's like it jumps off the page. It's just The more pathologizing lens is looking at this as willful behavior that the child has some sort of control over, versus if we can shift to this as a stress response, we can still look at these different environmental things are eliciting this response. It's the shift in how we then as the adults respond.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that comes to mind for me there is going to school, right? I see a lot of kids that even getting to school is very difficult for them, and coming at this of getting them in the door and they're melting down and all of that, like helping them to reframe that this is a stress response, that they're not trying to just be difficult or take charge in that moment. Like, I think of that one as such a concrete one that comes to mind for me that I see time and time again. And it's also interesting, I don't know if you guys find this though too, is sometimes then school will understand, oh yeah, like maybe that is anxiety, but I've had a lot of parents say it's interpreted as like the parent is causing that anxiety, because then the kid's fine once they're in school. And so, yeah, I don't know, have you guys navigated that of actually supporting that, and that it's not as easy just to go to like exposure therapy of, we'll get them in, then they're fine and they'll realize they're fine. I don't know if either of you have thoughts on that, but that one really comes to mind for me.
Sure. Yeah. That theme is almost like Groundhog Day for me and my work, right? Like, how many times have I had this conversation with teams?
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay, concierge clinical care, would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
And I do think it comes back to establishing that mutual understanding, right? I pride myself on not really losing my cool very often in IEP meetings. I'm pretty easygoing and pretty collaborative. But I did lose it in a meeting where an administrator said, I don't know, maybe she just wants to stay home and play with dolls. Mm. And it, clearly we did not have a shared understanding of what was happening for this learner. But there are times where, just like naming, back to that conversation of they wouldn't even do the evaluation, we ended up in a 504, and naming, I'm concerned about predetermination. Mm. I think naming that, I'm concerned that we are coming at this with two really different understandings. I am accommodating my child's nervous system disability. Your ask of telling me to just bring my child to school, you're actually asking me to violate trust with my child. That's a boundary I can't cross.
Boom. Wow. That's beautiful. And yeah, naming it, I think, can be such this powerful thing, because then we're not skirting around what the issue is. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
In addition to that, this does, it evolves this conversation. If we stay on that track of, they're fine at school, just get them here. We've got it. We've got it. We've got it. The intent is actually quite good. The intent is to reassure parents, to help them feel like their child is well held and well taken care of at school. It's not coming most of the time from a malintended place. I really don't feel people go into education with malintent. I just don't. But it is a misunderstanding of the situation. And so there are times, and I do think having a degree of separation as an IEP coach or advocate or as a professional in the two of you to name this instead of the parent having to name it, sometimes that's easier for someone in our roles to do. But naming for the team that I know that it might look fine, but it isn't. They are who they are in every situation. It's just the observable response is different in different situations, depending on their perceived sense of safety. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what you are most likely seeing is a freeze fawn response. Mm-hmm. And what we are seeing in the home is the fight flight, because they perceive more safety in the relationship. So while I appreciate you offering parenting coaching. And while I appreciate that you feel like this might be a home problem and they're fine at school, I'm here to tell you very respectfully, that's not the case. The environment where the child does not perceive safety is the school environment. I'm not pointing my fingers at anybody at this table saying you are not a safe person. I'm saying the environment at school and it being more of a compliance-driven system is incredibly triggering for my child. And so we need to be more mindful in the ways we think about accommodating their nervous system disability and recognizing that in this environment, their stress response looks like a freeze.
That's beautiful. Like, what a tangible thing for parents to take. Because I think parents often get stuck in this advocacy piece of helping how to explain it. And so I think it provides some tangibles. And I do often say, listen, if you bring me in to be part of this and this collaboration, I probably am going to say all the things you've already said, but sometimes the degrees of separation. But I also think the reality is, like, sometimes I think I wish it wasn't this way. I say this all the time, but I think coming in as a professional, they just automatically take it more seriously than they do from the parent. So I say, let me be your squeaky wheel. Let me be your voice in all of this. And I think it can make such a difference. One of the things in the course for me that I was like, ooh, I love this too, is this idea too of, and I don't even remember the wording you guys use, but basically trying to interpret what the kid is thinking. And Lisa, you used an example of maybe she just wants to stay home and play with dolls all day. Can you comment on that a little bit of assuming what the kid is thinking?
Well, I mean, my own child was the high masking, internalized freeze fawn. Right. So all I heard for years and years is she's so happy and she's so great and everything's wonderful. And it's okay. That's just not the reality. And so for me, I'm just big on naming the elephant in the room. And it is, it's so funny because I had so many years of experience as the parent at the table. So to come in and say really similar things as the coach at the table and have people listen, I think one of the things that I would hope the parents walk away from this podcast episode or anything they read on my social media or yours is that you've got to give yourself grace. Mm-hmm. When there are statements like, we just don't see it here, or they're fine, or they love school and they're happy here all the time, or whatever it may be, you have a nervous system as well, and you shut down. Those kinds of statements, intended as they most often are, literally end a conversation. And so the reason why, in part, those of us with a degree of separation can keep the conversation going and say the thing that the parent has probably already said is that we are not in our survival brain. We're still able to stay in our thinking brain and say the thing and keep the conversation going. Mm. But yeah, for me, I just feel so strongly about us not having the right to state what somebody else is experiencing, especially the irony when we're thinking about a PDAer where autonomy is so huge and we're so disrespecting their autonomy, their lived experience. Like, to me, it's just mind-boggling. But I always try to center. For me, the most important person, whether they're in the room or not in the room, it's immaterial, is the child. It is the child's IEP, full stop. It's their program. Yeah. And so if we are disregarding their perspective, then we are not acting with any kind of fidelity.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So good. So before we get into accommodations and interventions, let's just touch on real quick, like, what are some of the common educational classifications that if a kid is qualifying or a student is qualifying for an IEP that they're usually falling under?
I would say, generally speaking, if they're not meeting the eligibility criteria within the IDEA for autism, The kind of two that we're looking at are OHI, which stands for other health impairment, or ED, which is the emotional disturbance. And like you touched upon earlier, I'm not a lover of ED. I have a really strong bias against it. I really do feel like OHI can capture this well. To paraphrase the law, it's a heightened response to environmental stimuli. That seems like a pretty accurate capture of what's happening for these learners. But one of the things Jess and I talked about, and I certainly want to say in this space too, is that PDA transcends, like, it's not just one single thing. You talked about this in your sort of introduction episode on PDA, right? So we have non-speakers who have this nervous system disability, right? It transcends all boundaries, right? So there's representation from every, like, you can edit this out because I'm totally losing my words. But it's not just your high masking white, doesn't appear autistic,
right?
Right? Like, people of the global majority, non-speakers, autistic people of all support needs can have this wiring, hard wiring for a threat response to perceive loss of autonomy.
Right.
And I actually think, and maybe not in the scope of this podcast, but I do think the conversation around folks who are higher support needs, non-speaking, and have traits that match this PDA learning profile, there's so much top-down, almost disrespecting autonomy, not presuming competence that happens for our non-speakers, that, and then we're seeing behaviors and then we're really blaming the child. There's a whole host of stuff that I could keep going. I will stop. But
no, and I think it's so important because a lot of the conversation on social media right now is about this high masking autism profile, as well as in white individuals. And there's so much intersectionality that comes into this. For example, we know in terms of clinical diagnoses, Black boys are much more likely to get an ODD diagnosis. And in turn, they're going to be much more likely to be classified in the school as that ED, that emotional disturbance criteria, and all of that. And then yes, with non-speakers, the go-to is all these really behavioral strategies. And so super, super important that usually there's not that same difficulty of classifying and qualifying for an IEP sometimes when these overt behaviors are happening compared to more of the internalized experience. But I also think we still need to be thinking about those learners in this, and that we're not just talking about these high masking autistic individuals. So super important.
Yeah, I think when we were writing the course, I had such a hard time even defining PDA for this reason, because so many of the traits and characteristics that are centered and talked about really describe one type of child. And I'm grateful that has helped so many people identify this profile, but I'm concerned that it doesn't capture people that are non-speaking, right? That aren't a lot of the things like using humor and social tactics to get out of demands, right? That's not going to capture a child that's in burnout either. So I think that while it's added a lot to the conversation and helped a lot of people, I hope to see that continue to evolve.
Yeah. And I actually do have, it won't be recorded for a little bit, but a conversation coming up on intersectionality and talking about this conversation from more of this, what they classify themselves as is this critical PDA side. And that's some of the argument is we need to broaden our perspective. We need more research, all of that, but we also need to broaden our perspective in this. So I'm so glad both of you brought that up in this conversation. And obviously we could talk so much more about this, but I want to leave parents today or anyone listening with some tangible like accommodations and potential interventions. I know your course goes really deep into this. So obviously we don't have time to spend all of that here today, but what are some of those like key elements that you're thinking about? Maybe you get to the IEP table, right? And you're getting to this point of being like, great, we have an IEP. Now what? We have this mutual endeavor, the shared understanding. what are we doing in terms of goals?
Yeah, as we introduce in the course and whenever we're working with an IEP team, this kind of idea of behavior as brain state dependent, sensitive neuroception, and that what we're seeing is, and once we have that shared understanding, then we can arrive at the goal, which is always our goal of safety and cueing safety. And in our course, we talk about the different brain states. So when a child is more regulated, right, or showing early signs of activation to full-blown fight or flight or freeze or fawn. And we introduce interventions based on those different brain states, all with safety and autonomy in mind. When a child is more regulated or showing earlier signs of activation and their thinking brain is still online, that's where we'll see strategies like collaborative problem solving, declarative language. We might use role play or playfulness and humor to cue safety by reducing the stress response. And then as a child gets more activated, that's when we're gonna proactively start offering more co-regulation. So that's when we'll start seeing proactively offering a break, starting to be more mindful of our own body position and the level of our voice or talking less. So this is when I'm going to be really getting low down to a student, talking in a soft voice and not talking to whenever possible, right? And using my own nervous system to cue safety. And then we see that especially in what we call the red, but in that fight, flight, or freeze response, really not talking at all. And we're really looking to the environment to cue safety. Do I need to turn the lights down lower? I'm going to be totally silent near you in close proximity, but not looking at you. So that's how we conceptualize it, because teams often will have all these strategies, but not know when and how to use them. And Lisa's really great at getting that into the documentation and using the BIP or whatever it is we're working with, which I know you'll speak a little bit to, instruct the team, right? When you see this, and this is where we've identified the different cues, right? So we'll get into what does it look like for this learner when they're showing initial signs. Maybe they're getting extra silly. Maybe they're starting to yawn, or maybe they aren't eating. So these are some of those earlier signs. And then you respond, and that's where we get that into the documentation. Use declarative language, offer flexibility, lean in with playfulness, right? And then when we're documenting those signs of higher escalation, like a child throwing things or eloping, right? Some of the things we might see when they're more activated, jumping on a table is a big one for our PDAers. These are the strategies we use. And then those tend to be leaning more into our own nervous systems to cue safety.
Yeah. Just to highlight this real quick before you jump in, Lisa, I feel like this is an important piece, is schools are willing to do a lot of these things, right? And so it's getting on the same page about when they should have done.
Yes.
Because I think traditional behavioral models, what happens is we, as a kid activates, then we usually want to bring in the more quote unquote active things. Oh, let's do this, or let me explain it to you, or let me use all this declarative language. And it's almost, a lot of times it's reversed, right? We want to do less as the kid gets more activated versus the traditional schooling system tends to do more as the kid is activated. And so I think getting on the same page about that makes so much sense, that we're not actually asking schools to do that many things that are that novel. Maybe they don't know about declarative language. I don't know, but it's not outside of their scope.
Yeah. And I find that it actually feels more collaborative with teachers when we're talking this way, because then it's not so much, oh, terrible intervention, but, oh, I wonder if that was a sign that they were more activated than you thought. And that's why they responded poorly to you making a joke, right? So it's not so much that you're doing it wrong or that it's not working, but that we need to use that as information about the child's nervous system and what they're needing in that moment and adapt our response.
Oh, so good. So good. Yeah. Lisa, what do you want to add to this?
I think Jess encapsulated it so well. I don't know that I can add any more value to this conversation, but I do feel like you're touching on something really important, which is a lot of the things that we suggested in the course aren't necessarily so far outside of the realm of what a team has imagined. And so sometimes it's just like minor tweaks. Like I just came out of a meeting this morning and this young person is really more living in fight or flight. And so we're having sort of these daily episodes of things throwing and all that. And the teacher explained what she's doing in these moments and such good intention, but it's offering like a lot of choices, even if it's just between two things, right? Or naming, oh, I love that you decided to except what she unintentionally is doing is either placing a demand or stripping him of autonomy. Totally didn't realize. And so I think that sometimes I find, and this is so sad in many ways, that teams are a little bit more receptive to making these shifts when they haven't been successful using whatever model they're used to using.
Yeah, good point. Which is hard because it's like, why does the kid have to fail at using your strategies before we're willing to make a pivot? But I think this language of, what you're doing, let's just time it and sync it to some of these cues can be such a helpful mindset shift in all of this. The one question I do have is, what about this concept? And I know it's a broad one and we could probably talk forever about it, but reducing demands in the school, right? Like what is realistic and what is not realistic? Any like quick examples of things you do feel would be realistic in terms of reducing some of those demands or increasing autonomy in a way that we don't traditionally see in an educational setting?
What comes to mind for me is, yes, reducing demands, but Jess and I shared a family about a year ago now at this point, maybe 9 months ago. And the team kept saying, we've basically reduced all demands. There's nothing else we can reduce. And it's more than that. It's not just about reducing demands per se. It's how things are presented. And so one of the concepts that I learned from writing this course with Jess is the idea of strewing. So we've just placed something in the environment and just made a statement about noticing that it's in the environment, right? Oh, I'm noticing that everybody is lining up. I wonder if it's time for recess.
Yeah, right? Declarative language, right?
Yeah, the declarative language piece.
And strewing, those are two great ones.
Yeah, just you can speak to this better than I can, but I feel it's more nuanced than just reducing demands.
Yeah.
I think it's how those things are presented. And I don't want to give too much of the course away or take too much of everybody's time, but just share some really wonderful examples from times that she's been in classrooms with young children and their nervous systems activated and the choices that she's made in the moment with these young people in the classroom. Yeah. And one of the things that we talk about in the course is, and it came up in the meeting this morning, is it's one thing for us to be sitting here in the comfort of our homes having this conversation, and we're not the one responsible for cueing safety and helping a young person when they're activated and at the same time managing a classroom of however many other learners, right? And so being mindful, if we're thinking about in the context of an IEP and a conversation with a team, humanizing the teacher's experience or the service provider's experience in that moment, I think is really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll just add quickly that I think if we're using a lot of the interventions like declarative language, like offering flexibility, like doing things in a playful way, that we're already reducing demands. And sometimes when we say reduce demands, teachers get really activated, right? So it can be more helpful to give them these strategies, because on the kind of extreme side of things, one thing I'll see at times is, you know, teachers saying they've dropped all demands. And what that looks like is they're not even engaging and connecting with the child, right? It's almost like ignoring, right? And so we really want to break down strategies that build in connection to, and I see you, I got you, I'm here with you, I'm your partner, I'm your teammate, right? And that's what all of these more active strategies do, rather than this kind of concept of reduced demands, which is really important when done well and understood. But when it's not unpacked, I think the takeaway can leave teachers feeling more disengaged.
That's such an important point. I have a family I'm working with right now that the child actually has way more externalized behaviors in school than at home because of the accommodations provided at home. And in order to prevent him from escalating, they're just letting him nap. This is like an elementary age student during the day, right? Like he also is very bright. And so they can't keep up with his academic needs as well. And it's no, but that's not getting access to an appropriate education for him. No elementary school student should be napping in the middle of the day. So I think you're right that sometimes when we say this concept of reducing demands, and I talk about this as a whole, I think there's a lot of misconceptions of what that actually means. Some tangibles, real quick, I'll name off that actually were popping into my brain as you guys were talking. And some of these go broadly to the IEP is academics focused on just showing mastery versus yes. like repetition. Can we give less problems and know that they've done it? Can mm-hmm. we remove time limits, for example? Sometimes that's an internalized demand. Can we allow transition items, for example? There was one other one that I was thinking of. Oh, this one I find really a lot, and this is more neuroaffirming, is saying you need to be paying attention. Why aren't you listening? Stop fiddling with that, right? And allowing these like sensory things and realizing if the child's engaged, that we don't need to provide the way in which they're engaged too. All of those are demands that accumulate, I feel like, over time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you guys both agree with those and those feel realistic?
Yeah, I think extra processing time is a big one that's helpful. Definitely the reducing the workload and just showing mastery is a big one. Flexibility within assignments and choices within assignments. Some kids will switch the order of things that they do. So just building some kind of flexibility within assignment or choosing the topic, right? Those are just a few that are coming to my mind.
Those are great. Yeah.
Yeah, that was what came to mind too, the flexibility with assignments of not just like where they do it, right? Because I think that's a common accommodation, right? You can go take this and do this in the resource room, or you can go take this and do it outside, but being really flexible around the assignment itself, mm-hmm. right? As the teacher, asking yourself, what is it that I'm hoping a learner gets out of doing this assignment? What's the skill I'm hoping they can demonstrate? And if they want to do it by talking about something that's a passion point for them, or they are much more comfortable having a conversation with me versus standing up in front of the class, or the writing piece is a challenge, so can we do this a different way? Just being super flexible around all of that is great.
Yeah. And I don't even think that's PDA specific, right?
Like, no, a lot of these aren't. No. That's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just neuroaffirming.
Yeah.
You know, like
trauma informed. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. I think we're wrapping up. Anything else though, either one of you, and it's okay if the answer is no, but that's like burning in your brain that you want to be able to say before we talk about where people can find you, connect with you, all of that.
The only thing that comes to mind for me is I just want parents to know, and this is, I'm sure they've heard this a million times, but this is a marathon, not a sprint. And you don't have to have all the right answers right away. An IEP and a 504, they're fluid documents. You don't have to like get it all right, whatever that means, right away. Every meeting, every interaction is an opportunity to move the needle a little, and just give yourself a ton of grace in this process.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we are going to link in the show notes the link for the course. So if anyone wants to go and continue learning, you're really struggling with this. I mean, I asked Jessica and Lisa to be on the podcast because I was finding so much value out of it as a clinician, but I encourage you to go dive in. But for each of you too, if people are looking to connect with you, where can they do that?
Yeah. So I have a private practice and I do therapy coaching for parents. And I also do consultation privately with different schools, and I consult for local public school districts. So my private practice is called PDA Project, and that's where you'll see me hanging out and where you can find me.
I didn't realize that was the name of your private practice. Yeah. Okay. And so can you talk about the state piece? Can you only practice in the state you're in, or do you have a coaching offer that's more broad?
Oh, yeah. Right now, all of my clients are in California. That's where I'm licensed. And I am also have an educational practice where I can do coaching as well. Okay. So I'll be expanding that part soon.
Okay. Exciting. Awesome. And Lisa, what about you?
That's very exciting, Jessica. I am also located in California, but because I don't provide therapy, I support families all over the country. And so I offer a group coaching community. We meet weekly. We bring in guest speakers. There's resources within the community. It's really been quite lovely. I know you have a group community as well. It's just such a powerful, safe space for families to come. But I also support families ongoing in the IEP process. I'm currently in a little bit of a transition. I'm moving, so I pressed pause, but starting back up in June, I offer these 1-hour Ask Me Anything consultations. And I have the course with Jessica, and I have another course that I did on my own called a Neurodiversity Affirming Approach to IEPs, both of which are available on demand and watch and go through at your leisure.
Okay. And then your Instagram is...
My Instagram is Lisa Baskin Wright.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you both so much for this conversation today. I think it was so needed. And I know I'm even walking away with some important tangibles. So I know parents listening to this, really reframing, I think, this idea of the mutual endeavor, also recognizing that it's not the interventions always that are the problem. It's the timing and how we can help cue the educational team. And just knowing too, that parents can advocate for this, that predetermination. I was like, oh, I love that so much. So thank you both for being here today. I really appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, y'all. That is a wrap for today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. I will see you back here next time.
Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.